I was at a conference recently with policymakers and scientists, and everybody has this extremely pessimistic view on what AI is going to be doing and how it's going to be impacting our lives. You seem to have some more of an optimistic perspective. I mean, what do you think the more tangible impacts in the next, you know, 5-10 years will be on, you know, our lives and society in general?
I think that every generation needs to have a pending doom narrative. And so I think for our parents' generation, it was actually very credible nuclear pending doom. Certainly, if you read about the industrial era, there's a lot of pending new material there. So AI is now what we like to pontificate about over dinner.
Welcome back to the AI Element. I'm your host, Alex Shi, and the person you just heard is Dan Gross of Y Combinator, who we spoke to in our very first episode of the season. The pending doom narrative that Dan describes is how you typically hear about AI in the media. Doomsday Skynet scenarios, robots taking jobs. It might be less sexy and sensational, but we less often hear about what AI can do for good, which is a shame, because there are a lot of people doing incredible things with it. People like Charles C. Onu.
My name is Charles. I was born in Nigeria. I spent quite an amount of my adult life, you know, working on social causes. And it was in all of that I came across the work that I'm doing right now.
In this episode, Charles will show us what it looks like when you're passionate about the problems you're solving. His project, Ubenwa, is what some call the Shazam for babies.
We are trying to develop an AI that can detect birth asphyxia from the cry of a baby. So in Nigeria and in many other countries of the world, birth asphyxia is one of the top causes of infant mortality today. In particular, it's when the baby is unable to establish regular breathing right after birth. And one of the problems with this is that it's hard to detect, usually until the visual signs emerge. But usually at that point, it's too late because baby has suffered from neurological damage from oxygen starvation to the brain.
Oxygen starvation to the brain can cause permanent damage to the digestive system, kidneys, respiratory system, brain, and more. In extreme cases, oxygen deprivation can lead to complete organ failure and death.
To give the numbers, as at last year, 2016, from the WHO, 1 million babies died from asphyxia last year, and about 1.2 million or so suffered from severe lifelong disabilities. It's ranked by WHO as one of the top three causes of infant mortality today. And it turns out that there's really no low-cost means for diagnosis available. Currently, you need to diagnose in a machine known as a blood gas analyzer, which is really expensive, requires experts to operate, and requires power, which we cannot guarantee in Nigeria, and so many other things. And so now we're looking at if we can use the cry to diagnose asphyxia.
But working in this space wasn't always Charles's plan.
For a very long time, I've had interest in healthcare. I was this close to studying medicine. Like, I had already applied and I withdrew my application just because I was so confused between engineering and medicine. So I chose engineering ultimately, but my passion for medicine was still there. And so when the opportunity presented itself for me to combine my skills in engineering to some important problem in healthcare, I guess it was a no-brainer for me.
What's the AI angle on this? Like, how is that helping you and what are you doing?
So one of the first things is the physiologic process through which cry and speech is produced. For most of us humans, it's intuitive. You know that there's like this connection between your breathing system and your speaking system. The same region of the brain coordinates both activities. Oh. But also the same set of organs oscillate when you speak and when you breathe. In babies, it's even more pronounced than it is in we adults, because unlike adults, you know, I could speak louder or softer if I wanted to speak, but babies don't have the ability to modulate the sound they produce. And as one researcher put it, the cry of a baby is a true reflection of its inner physiologic state. Hmm. So consequently, when a baby is not breathing well, there's an alteration in the patterns of its speech. Hmm. But as you can imagine, these patterns are very complex. It's not a simple thing where you could write an algorithm that can, you know, detect this, and then voila, you have a detection. So that's where AI comes in, because as you probably know, AI gives us methods for learning complex relationship from existing data. And so that's what we're doing, really. We're taking cries of babies that we know have had asphyxia, cries of babies that were normal, and then developing AI that can learn the complex patterns.
For a listener that doesn't know how to build an AI, you're doing supervised learning. What were the steps that you needed to go through to arrive at building your solution?
For all machine learning problems, step one is get data.
Yeah, exactly. So how did you collect that data?
So that's such a huge problem, especially in healthcare. In other problems, collecting data can be easy, like in text problems, you can collect it from the internet and so on. But, you know, you can't go and collect cries of babies who have asphyxia from the internet. And so that poses a problem because, one, it has to be done in a hospital setting. Yeah, it's going to cost a lot of money to do that. Money, time, experts need to get approval. And so to do the pilot work, we collaborated with some researchers in Mexico who were looking at causes of deafness in newborns, because deafness is one of the primary disabilities that could result from asphyxia. So they had this small data set of cries of normal babies, asphyxiating babies, and deaf babies. And so the ones of interest to us was that of the normal and asphyxiating babies. And so we after much work, we obtained this data from them. And then we used it to do our pilot work, which showed that we could detect with the system we developed, which I'll come back to.
Yeah.
We could detect asphyxia up to about the 90% accuracy. And for us, it was important to do this pilot proof of concept in a quick manner too, because, well, as I mentioned, it's very expensive to collect your own data set. But also we needed to confirm this hypothesis before we could move forward.
No data, no AI.
Simple.
When we talk about data in this context, what we're talking about is the sound associated with these different problems. So the sound that was telling you whether it was good or bad. And then from there, you used artificial intelligence techniques in supervised learning, which you mentioned earlier, to be able to arrive at the result of proving out that artificial intelligence could, using data and using structure, could tell you whether a baby had asphyxia or not.
Exactly.
So where are you in terms of deploying?
We are repeating the data step because, as you can imagine, we've built a system from 70 babies. In the AI world, that's very small, fairly small. And we want to be able to use a larger set of babies to validate what we've done, just to be sure that it's really scalable, both across geographic regions, different demographic groups. And so that's in particular why we've chosen to do this data validation process both in Nigeria and in Canada. And so currently we are applying for ethics approval to do this, both more data acquisition and then validation of what we have built. And we're doing the same in Nigeria as well. And the goal is that we'll acquire more data, hopefully in the thousands, and we can revalidate, update, improve what we've developed. And then we can come to the point where we have enough data, enough results to request regulatory approval and license to operate. So there's still the approval part from the health agencies that has to go through before we then can begin to distribute and have people use it. So in different countries, it's going to be very different. We're at the point where we're actually raising funds for this process.
Ah, there we
really,
go.
Really, really expensive.
What's more, Charles didn't start with a massive data set.
It was about 70 babies in total.
So 70 babies.
Yeah.
If what you're doing is right, 70 babies will probably help save 1 million lives.
Yes, indeed.
When you're passionate about solving a problem, lack of data, funding, access to education, many things don't feel like obstacles.
Now more than ever, knowledge has been democratized greatly, and you really don't need a PhD to at least apply machine learning to problems, AI to problems. I personally didn't have any formal training in AI before I started working on this. My first degree was in electronics and computer engineering, but I learned it from home by watching videos online, taking lectures online and taking courses and from, you know, top schools in the US. And that was how I got here, yeah.
If you think teaching yourself AI online is impressive, Charles taught himself programming, even though he rarely had access to electricity.
Yeah, the power thing is a real problem in Nigeria till today. Like, on the average, you'd see power in your house for an hour or so per day. Yeah, it's really bad. I learned programming by carrying my, because then I had a desktop machine, and I was one of the few who has parents who could afford a desktop computer. I would have to carry it then when I was in school. to a salon, a barbing salon, right across from the street with my roommate. He carries the system unit, I carry the monitor. And then we go there. We first write our programs on paper because, you know, you didn't have much time to waste. You write it on paper first and you go there and start typing it and then test it to see if it works and debug and stuff. And then we carry it back home. That was how I learned programming for my undergrad days.
So you are, let's say you're at home, finish your degree, and you decide to go online and do courses and you suddenly end up with one of the world experts in reinforcement learning at McGill. What am I missing there? How did you get from there to here?
Okay, so I finished my first degree in 2011, studied electronics and computer engineering, as I said. Right the year after 2012, I started working full-time as a software developer. But it was during this time I continued my work with the NGO and I started working on this problem, partly because I saw the challenge. Eventually, when I saw that there was a solution, a potential solution with AI, I was like, okay, I told myself, okay, I have to go and learn this AI. Yeah. And so I bought a few books there and tried to read a few material then. But it was really hard actually to learn because 5 years ago in 2012, even in Canada, the word AI was not as pervasive as it is today.
Yeah.
How much more in Nigeria? It was so hard to access for me. And I had almost given up until these MOOC platforms came up, like Coursera and edX.
These MOOC platforms that Charles is describing, massive open online courses like those offered on Coursera, edX, Udemy, were early but important steps towards the democratization of AI. In August 2011, Stanford professor Andrew Ng uploaded an intro video to YouTube for his free online machine learning course. Over 100,000 students registered, which inspired Ng to launch Coursera a few months later with fellow Stanford professor Daphne Koller. Charles was in the first cohort of that class.
I was scouring the internet looking for accessible material to learn machine learning and AI. And I found a course, and that was the first course that I used to get a general feel of the concept and begin to take like more complex material on it. And so I spent like a year of learning at home and so on, like in the evenings after work. And ultimately, I was able to then start working on problems of my own. So that was the path. I still had to supplement what I learned on the internet with what I had learned in school, for sure. Like I did engineering. I didn't do a social science program or something. So I still had a good background to pursue the knowledge in AI. I had done calculus, which is a fundamental part of AI. You know, I had done probability and statistics. I had done some of the background you need to actually begin to learn stuff in the field.
Some of our listeners might not have access to all the resources, education, or maybe they're just passionate about something they want to use AI with. What do you tell them?
I think to do AI, you can do it from home, really. Especially if you are looking not to invent a new AI algorithm, but to apply it to real problems. I mentioned that we obtained this data and did some pilot work in which we showed that we could detect asphyxia with as much as 90% accuracy. I did all of that before I came to McGill. So I did all of that when I was still in Nigeria, not here. So the reason I came here is because I have interest in going deeper into the field. So I think really there's a lot of very good material on Coursera, on edX, on Udacity. There's so many online platforms.
AI makes solutions accessible at a global scale that can be impactful in social, economic, health ways that really will benefit the world.
Because exactly, I think one of the biggest benefits is that not only would AI make what was not possible before possible, for instance, detecting asphyxia from the cry, but it would also make it possible in ways that are exponentially cheaper than the current ways of doing it. Especially within healthcare, there's so many diseases that we can diagnose using AI methods, whether it's detecting cancer from images, or whether it's detecting eye defects from also scans of the eye. We've invented so many medical devices, you know, MRI, EEG, ECG, and so on and so forth to measure such complex things from the human body over time. But the doctors are only humans, and how much of this can they consume at once to make a good decision about one patient?
This, of course, extends outside of healthcare. Around the world, people are using AI to solve problems of all sorts, economic, social, and political. I asked Charles how listeners should know what kind of problems they can solve with AI.
What are you passionate about? What excites you? What do you care about? And usually you'd find that there's a way you can use AI to solve problems within that space.
We spoke to Redia Davibi from Cornell University about the inspiring work she's doing with organizations like Black in AI and Mechanism Design for Social Good.
Hi, I'm Redia Davibi. I'm a PhD student at Cornell University, where I'm working on algorithms, AI, and applications to social good.
I asked Redia how she sees AI for good working today.
Basically, what I want is for our field to solve problems that could be to the benefit of everyone. And I think these areas that we're now focused on are more marginalized communities, right? So it could be marginalized communities or sort of communities that have historically not had as many opportunities as some other groups, right? So this could be, you know, the developing world, or it could be questions about socioeconomic inequality. It could be questions about improving access to quality education. So all these things that could potentially improve people's lives, but not everyone is sort of afforded the same opportunities. And so trying to bridge that gap and trying to put out products that could be to the benefit of all of society, you know, as time goes on, maybe that will change, right? Maybe our problems will change. Maybe what could be the most beneficial to people could change. So it has to be an adaptable definition. But I think that's where we are right now.
Redia explains that there are two things that need to happen for AI for good to fully benefit marginalized communities of today. The first is representation.
I think if you want to have a field that works for all of society, then the field itself has to be representative of all of society, right? And so if you want to make sure that AI works for Black people, you need to have enough Black people in your community. If you want to make sure that AI works for the developing world, you need to have enough people from the developing world involved and represented and included in your community. So I was realizing this, and you know, I think we've come a long way in terms of increasing diversity and inclusion in our community, but there was still a long way to go.
The second thing that needs to be put into place is a more interdisciplinary approach.
You know, what we've learned over a number of years is that the problems that we're solving are not purely technical, right? They interact with the world and they are inspired by the world. And so it would be a huge loss, I think, to treat AI problems as being purely technical problems. And we have to think about issues of, say, fairness and ethics, and we have to think about, you know, how we're impacting inequality and whether we're improving it and so on, right? And the good news here is that there are many fields in, you know, social sciences, philosophy, and others that have been thinking about precisely these concerns, right? Inequality, fairness, ethics, like all these things that we're now, you know, very worried about. And so I think that in order for us to make good progress, and I think to solve maybe the right problems or maybe have the largest impact that we can have, I think that the best solutions are going to be at the interface of these existing disciplines. It's not just going to be a purely technical solution, right?
Redia co-founded Black in AI to address the problem of representation in AI.
It would be really helpful if we had a community of Black researchers in AI that, you know, we could all support one another, we could share resources, collaborate on ideas, see how we can increase our presence and our inclusion in the community. And this was sort of inspired by what the Women in Machine Learning workshop had done, right? There were very few women in machine learning, and they created this community, and it's made a significant impact in increasing the presence of women in machine learning and also making them feel more included. That's one of the hows, right? I think if you want to make AI work for all of society, you just have to just include more people in your field and let that be a resource to your field.
So what are some groups that you see working with AI for good?
So I mentioned our group Mechanism Design for Social Good, which is working on using algorithmic and AI tools to improve access to opportunity, which has a website, md4sg.com. So that's one. And recently, the MacArthur Foundation has funded a number of initiatives that are focused on societal implications of AI. And one of these based at Cornell, the AI policy and practice group. And through this group, we've been exploring issues at this interface of AI and society, including AI for social good and fairness concerns. And there's one called AI and Data Science in the Developing World that's run by Ernest Mobezi, who's at Makerere University in Uganda. And his group is working on projects that are funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and specifically focused on AI for the developing world. There's also Black and AI, where people in the group are also focused on AI for social good and algorithmic fairness, in addition to a variety of other fields.
So what is algorithmic fairness?
So algorithmic fairness is basically concerned with the observation that if you have data which is biased, which a lot of data is, right? There's biases in how it's collected. There's biases in what is in the data itself, right? And you don't account for these biases, then let's say that you're using this data to decide whether someone's loan is going to be approved or not, right? Or whether someone's going to get bail or not, or any of these super consequential decisions, right? If you're using some algorithm to do that and you already have biased data, then biases that exist in the data that are a result of historical discrimination, right, do end up influencing the decisions that you make using these algorithms. So for instance, you know, if you are Black and you have applied for a bunch of loans and you got rejected, let's say, you know, for a variety of reasons, one of which is also that, you know, there's just bias against Black people, then yeah, if you show up to a new person and they have to decide whether they're going to give you a loan or not, and they're using an algorithm to decide that, then this decision-making tool has decided that previous rejections for loans are an indication that maybe you're not trustworthy, right? Then it's just going to look at that and say, okay, you've been rejected a bunch of times, so maybe this means that you're not trustworthy, and so now I'm going to reject you this loan. Yeah, so there's research now attempting to kind of de-bias some of these algorithms, but there's a long way to go.
I asked Reddit how she thinks AI will change the future for good.
I think it's very difficult to sort of decide now what's going to be helpful for people in 10 years, right? The whole issue is that problems change very quickly. The field changes very quickly. You know, who knows what we're going to be faced with in 10 years, right? We have some ideas, but, you know, I'm sure we had ideas about where we'll be now 10 years ago. And, you know, some of them were right and some of them were not.
Though change is inevitable, Reddit shares three trends that she sees as helpful to the future of AI. The first being the rapid technical advances.
So one thing is that there's very rapid technical advances in AI. You know, we're in a much different place than we were 5 years ago. And I think that's really exciting. I think that we have the ability to potentially transform entire areas is really exciting.
The second trend that Reddit thinks is promising is that there's an increased awareness that AI can be biased.
Another thing is also what we've been talking about, which is that there's this increased awareness that AI interacts with existing inequalities and could potentially mitigate or exacerbate already existing inequalities. And I think that awareness is really helpful because it could mean that there will be deeper engagement from the community to understand, you know, what these already existing inequalities look like and potentially contribute to our understanding of that, or even maybe target some efforts to mitigate that.
The third trend is that increasingly, people are taking an interdisciplinary approach to solving problems in AI, rather than a purely technical approach.
Approaching AI as sort of an interdisciplinary field rather than a purely technical problem. And there's this appreciation now that solutions to problems are potentially going to be lying at the interface of existing disciplines. And that's why we're seeing these interdisciplinary conferences and interdisciplinary collaborations and these groups that we've been talking about that support this. And, you know, whatever ends up being the most impactful product of AI in 10, 15 years, it's probably going to be a byproduct of some combination of these things that I've mentioned.
So that's it for season 1 of the AI Element. I hope you liked it as much as we enjoyed putting it together. This is our first run, and we'd love to do another season. There are also so many great AI projects and people behind them to talk to, but we're going to need your help to get the show out there. Rate us on Apple Podcasts and share with a friend. If you're curious about something you heard on the episode and want to know more, or want to find the websites of our guests, we've put together a little reading list in the show notes. Check it out at elementai.com/podcast. The AI Element is produced by Steph Colburn at Edit Audio and Amanda Durupo at Element AI. Special thanks to Simon Hudson, Erica Kanna, Jacob Schreier, Weiwei Lin, Genevieve Jacobella-Remian, Katie Yam, Christophe Coutel, and Caroline Bourbagnin. You can find out more about each episode at elementai.com/podcast.